Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. In re Halliburton Company and Brown & Root Energy Services, a petition for writ of mandamus. In re Allstate County Mutual Insurance Company and others, also a petition for writ of mandamus. And American Cyanamid Company versus Terry and Brandon Guy from Eastland County and the 11th Court of Appeals. In each of these causes, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments by noon, I hope. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of the court, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready for argument from relators in N. Ray Halliburton.
May it please the court, Mr. Carl Jordan will present argument for relator. The relator is reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I would like to address the issues of whether a valid and binding arbitration agreement was created under the principles enunciated by this court in its Hathaway decision, and as part of that discussion, whether there was valid consideration on both sides underlying that agreement. The general rule enunciated by this court in Hathaway was that when an at-will employer announces a changed term or condition of employment, the employee must accept or quit, and that if the employee continues to report to work, he or she is deemed, as a matter of law, to have accepted the contract.
How obscure can this announcement be?
Your Honor, it needs to be clear and unequivocal, according to what this court said in Hathaway. Hathaway rule is a generally applicable rule of contract formation.
But do you have to prove actual knowledge and understanding, or ample and adequate opportunity to understand, or where does the cutoff come? If we have a situation where somebody did not know and appreciate that there had been a change of condition,
Chief Justice,
what do we look at in a mandamus non-factual resolution setting?
Chief Justice Phillips, what we submit, it is the latter of the two propositions you first articulated, that the opportunity must be proven. And for that proposition, we would refer the court to the Burlington Northern versus ACPAN decision of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, which is a case really on all fours with this case, where the Court of Appeals said on page 51 of its opinion that in law, what fairly puts a person on inquiry is sufficient notice. And then it went on to say that where the plaintiff or where the employee had received clearly written materials regarding, through the mail, regarding the arbitration, the employer's arbitration program, but had failed to read them, that he nevertheless was charged with notice. And it said the party providing unequivocal notice of changes in employment terms cannot force the other party to assimilate and understand the information in the notification.
Have we got any type of, should we have any type of conspicuousness requirements in that notice, or how do we judge it?
Chief Justice Phillips,
in Sanskrit, it clearly wouldn't do.
We would submit that you cannot have, that the state of Texas cannot impose conspicuous requirements that would go beyond what is required to create a contract between private parties under normal circumstances. That is the holding of the United States Supreme Court under the Federal Arbitration Act in the Doctors Associates case, the Southland case, and the Perry v. Thomas case is all cited in our brief.
Well, is your answer to saying that the FAA doesn't apply?
If the FAA doesn't apply
the case, would your answer be the same or different?
If the FAA did not apply, my answer would not necessarily be the same. but there's no dispute in this case but that the FAA applies to the other side. Mr. Myers has conceded that. With regard to the kind of notice that was provided, the facts, the material facts in this case are undisputed. Brown and Root adopted a dispute resolution program which included a mandatory arbitration component. It mailed materials to all of its employees beginning in May of 1993 on four separate occasions before Mr. Myers' claim, which he asserts in this lawsuit, arose. He claims that in 1998 he was demoted from general foreman to first-line foreman because of his age. That's his underlying
claim.
Does
it make any difference in how we apply Hathaway if we're dealing with a discrimination claim that has been the subject of legislation by the state of Texas?
No, Justice Hankinson, it does not. Again, the U.S. Supreme Court addresses that. Most recently in the Circuit City case decision, which is just a few months old and cited in our reply brief, there the court, in response to amicus briefs that were filed by over 20 state attorney generals raising the issue you just raised, said that we've addressed this issue in our Southland and Perry versus Thomas decision, and the fact that an employment discrimination statute that may be that is a state statute may provide a right to jury trial does not override the instruction of the Federal Arbitration Act. Now, bear in mind also that in both Gilmer and in Circuit City, the U.S. Supreme Court applied or enforced mandatory arbitration agreements in employment discrimination cases that were brought under federal employment discrimination statute. So the rule applies equally whether the statute, the statutory claim is federal or state.
Well, but from looking at it from the perspective of state law, since you're asking us to apply Hathaway, which is a decision of this court and part of the common law of the state of Texas in its effort to apply contract principles in the at-will employment context, my question then becomes under the state common law, should there be more required with respect to an acceptance on the part of the employee given what is at stake under state law?
Again, my answer is that there cannot be more required because Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act says that arbitration agreements that comport with generally applicable principles of contract formation under state law must be enforced. And that is the limited role that state law plays in cases where arbitration agreements are subject to the FAA. Contract formation rules and then common law defenses to contract formation that are all generally applicable. Special rules cannot be carved out under these Supreme Court cases.
That's the only unique state law we're looking at, then let's talk about contract formation. What consideration did you give here other than agreeing to go to an arbitration process that you wanted in the first place?
Well, there are several aspects of consideration. Let me first point out, if I can, that the mutuality, the courts are generally consistent on the principle that the mutuality of the agreement to arbitrate is valid legal consideration for both parties. And there are cases cited, I think, in our brief from at least two of the different circuits.
Let me ask you about that. Under the terms of this particular program that you offered, that your client offered the employees, Brown and Root at any point in time could change the terms, could withdraw it, could unilaterally act to remove whatever consideration was there. Doesn't that in some way affect whether or not there really was consideration and actually a binding contract between the parties?
Justice Hankinson, I would take exception to the statement that they could unilaterally remove the consideration. They can amend and even terminate on a going forward basis the plan, but they cannot amend or terminate on a retroactive basis, and any claim that has arisen or that the company has knowledge of by the very terms of the plan cannot be affected by any amendment or termination. That duty to arbitrate on the part of Brown and Root will always be there once it has notice of a potential dispute, and it cannot do anything under the terms of the plan or its contractual obligations to avoid that duty?
The employee is going to have to prove notice of the plan to Brown and Root in order to then have the, any benefits that the plan would provide to them.
Notice of the dispute.
Once Brown and Root has knowledge, whether it comes from the employee or any other source.
I understand, but the employee would then have to prove that knowledge in order to prove that the plan was still in effect as to them if they wanted to. They would have to prove the knowledge or notice on the part of Brown and Root of the potential claim in order to be able to have the benefit of the plan.
If Brown and Root were to terminate the plan, yes. And also, there's a 10-day advance notice requirement for a plan termination as well. So they have to.
Does that same provision apply with respect to amendments to the plan?
The 10 days does not. The prospective only limitation does. And we have, by the way, cited cases in our briefs for the proposition that limiting the right to amend or terminate to prospective situations is valid legal consideration. That is a legal detriment that Brown and Root has incurred, and therefore it is valid consideration.
But I don't understand in terms of what the terms of the plan are with respect to amending the plan. What kind of limitations are there on Brown and Root for limiting or amending the plan?
On a going forward basis, with regards to claims that have not come forward, there is none. They can change it just like they can decide to no longer provide medical benefits to their employees on a going forward basis, or to reduce all their employees' compensation to minimum wage on a going forward basis. It is no different from any other term or condition of employment in that respect.
But does the same rule apply that if a claim has arisen, then they are and they have notice or knowledge of the claim, that they are then unable to amend the plan with respect to that claim?
That is correct. They could not do so. Brown and Root could not do so.
There are facets that could have been put in this plan that would have rendered it unconscionable, I presume. Or if you'd had to go to an arbitration service that charged $10,000 a day. Is that correct?
Chief Justice Phillips, certainly that is correct. A plan could be written in an unconscionable way. We believe this plan was crafted to be a model of due process, and we think the record evidence shows that.
If the record were to be developed, this might have to be at a trial, to show that these types of age discrimination claims generally could be represented in the courts on a contingency fee contract, if you got past... Certainly, if you got past the board hurdle or something that you could generally find an attorney, and that you generally cannot find an attorney for the amount of money that you would provide. For the $2,500 maximum that you would provide for attorney's fees, generally people would not do an arbitration case. Would that be a material factor on unconscionability?
Not a factor in this instance, because remember, the $2,500 legal aid benefit is consideration, we believe, but it does not limit the employee in any way in terms of finding a lawyer, entering into any fee contract he would enter into if the matter were a lawsuit rather than an arbitration. And indeed, as is clear in the record, this arbitration plan has a fee-shifting provision that runs only to the benefit of claimants, to employees embodied in it, and shifts the fees in the discretion of the arbitrator if the employee prevails, even if the claim that's being brought doesn't contain a statutory fee-shifting.
Your plan's been around for 8 years now.
Since 1993, June of 1993.
So would it be relevant to look at the history of the 8 years of operation, how many times fees have been shifted, how many times employees have been able to secure an attorney, how many initial notices have gone all the way through the four-step process? At some point, could that history be looked at to determine unconscionability?
I do not believe that would be an appropriate analysis. I believe that unconscionability would have to be judged on the face of the program. Now, if there were fact issues about unfair application of the program that departed from its face, that would be an issue, but there's been no issue of that sort raised in this case. There's nothing in the record to indicate that that's happened.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Barbara Gardner will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm Barbara Gardner, and I represent J.D. Myers, who's a welder with a high school diploma who welded for Brandon Roo for over 30 years.
Ms. Gardner, how would your situation be different if the employer had terminated your client here and then offered to rehire him under these terms? How would your argument change?
My argument would not change because the terms of the plan as they are unconscionable.
And is that a question for us to decide from the face of the plan, or is that a fact question for the jury?
It is a fact question as to whether or not there was a binding contract, i.e. an arbitration contract. But as far as the makings of this plan, it's a question of law. In fact, we are offering that to the court to decipher that particular question on notice, on nature of the changes, on imposition of the certainty.
So you're asking us to decide those unconscionability issues as a matter of law?
That can be decided. I'm not asking in my particular delivery today that you decide all the unconscionability factors.
But as to the contract principles, if the company had fired your client, which they could have done under an at-will agreement, and then offered to hire him back under these terms, what would be the contract issues involved that would be different from the situation we have here? I mean, I don't understand why that wouldn't be a valid contract in that instance. And how do you distinguish that from what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. In neither instance would it be a valid contract because Brown & Root's promise to arbitrate is illusory. They can amend it, they can withdraw it, or change it at any time. So no matter when the employee works there, sooner or later, it's still an illusory promise.
Well, how do you counter the argument, though, that there is a mutuality of the arbitration provision? So once Brown & Root has agreed to arbitrate, if there's a period of 6 months and your client has a claim during those 6 months, and thereafter Brown & Root alters or modifies or terminates the plan, they have nevertheless agreed to arbitrate within that six-month period. How do you get around that?
Now, in that scenario, it could be a contract. It could be a unilateral contract. But as the contract...
Well, that's not unilateral at that point. That is a mutual agreement.
Yes, a mutual set of promises. At the time those promises are given, Brown & Root's promise is illusory, no contract. Brown & Root can amend that promise the day these brochures went out in the mail. Brown & Root can amend or change at any time before, and the plan on page 5 says actual notice. That's capitalized. Actual notice, and this whole booklet has to do with the rules of arbitration. So actual notice would be notice of arbitration.
Well, how do you distinguish that from the medical plan or an employee benefit plan? Most of those plans allow the employer to unilaterally amend. Do we call all those illusory contracts?
No, Your Honor. The difference here is that this is a waiver of constitutional rights in this instance. This is not a matter of
What's
medicine.
What's your constitutional right?
The waiver that we're talking about is whether or not the employee has enough information to make a decision knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, and with sufficient awareness of the facts to know the legal circumstances.
I didn't hear the constitutional right in that response.
Yes, Your Honor. The constitutional right is not given by the plan or taken away by the plan. The constitutional right is what the employee is asked to give up.
And what is that right?
A right to a jury trial.
Isn't that true of every arbitration? I mean, you could claim a constitutional due process deprivation in any arbitration.
Not exactly, Your Honor. That would be if some action were taken. We're talking about pre-dispute. We're talking about the time when the employee is trying to make a decision whether or not to do what this says. And if the employee does not understand what this says, he gives up his right to a jury trial and a due process without knowing so.
But arbitration agreements are in security agreements, home sales agreements, consumer, all sorts of agreements.
Yes, Your Honor. And there have been arbitration agreements for centuries in the maritime setting. And in the commercial setting, that is a good thing. That it works. But
well,
usually,
but they're waiving the right there. Why wouldn't you have the question in every case that you've waived your right in all those cases?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason is, in the commercial setting, those parties are on equal bargaining terms. Usually they are advocates on the equal terms, financially and otherwise. Same with the maritime. If you have a ship down there in a port and it's running up demurrage, they want to get that done now.
I haven't been on equal terms with our stockholders in years.
Centuries.
Thank you. Good point. And in fact, that illustrates my point in the employment setting. The employer has much more power, much more wherewithal to go hire attorneys. These employees, such as Mr. Myers, who have a high school diploma, they are not on equal footing. And I say in that instance, especially in discrimination, that should not be arbitrated unless this employee has full awareness of the legal consequences.
What about in a union situation? Are there arbitration agreements there?
Yes, there are, and thank you for that question because it allows me to discuss the case of Wright, the Supreme Court case of Wright, decided by Justice Scalia. In a collective bargaining situation, the union can bargain to give away these constitutional rights on behalf of the members. But Supreme Court says only if that waiver is clear and unmistakable. And that same standard has been adopted in other cases. I believe the Harris case out of the Fifth Circuit recently. So even in a union setting, to waive these constitutional rights, it must be done in a clear and unmistakable way.
Let's go
what
off on that point.
What would have to happen here? What would it take to have a valid waiver?
It would take the kind of language that an everyday worker can understand. Comparing to what
court other than the Ninth Circuit that's adopted this view in the employment context?
Which view is that? The collective bargaining agreement?
No. The collective bargaining agreement is somewhat different because that's somebody else waiving it for you. I'm talking about is there any court that has said that we're not going to enforce an arbitration agreement in an employment setting unless it's clear and unmistakable so that, much like our waiver, shifting burden of negligence and said, no, you've got to read it and nobody in the world can misunderstand it.
Right.
You haven't. What's the authority that is the law in Texas or in the United States generally?
An analogous case in Texas is Fort Worth ISD versus Southwestern Bell. Those were bargaining probably on the same level, but the waiver of constitutional rights there, and it was a tax issue with the state court, the waiver of constitutional rights, even in that instance, with those parties, had to be intelligently, voluntarily, and knowingly made.
But we're operating under a statute here. We're really not making up the law ourselves in the first instance. We're operating under the FAA. And there's not much that the state court has left to its discretion.
The FAA comes in only when we have a contract. That's a question of arbitrability.
Contract formation is ours. And that
correct. Contract law.
Now, in the arbitration context, what jurisdictions have imposed this high burden on the person who wants arbitration to show that the agreement was valid?
There is no specific case on waiver of constitutional rights in the arbitration setting. However, there is an employment case out of the 14th Court of Appeals, the Houston case of Dilley versus Sisters of Charity. That was an employment case where the plaintiff, an employee, had negotiated an agreement with the employer. The plaintiff was a doctor, and he negotiated this contract for himself. Within that contract, he agreed to give up notice of any termination or any cause of termination. course, later when he was fired, he claimed he did not have his due process rights. The court denied that particular case, but in that employment case, the Houston court said, nevertheless, that arbitration, that any sort of waiver of constitutional rights has to be knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently done. So I think that is a case that is close to our facts. And we have a recent case, Davidson versus Webster, out of the Corpus Christi Court of May 2001. That case is very analogous to our case. It had to do with arbitration. It had to do with facts just almost identical to this one. And what is also identical to this case, and the case turned on the fact that the plan, the arbitration plan, can be amended or changed or terminated at any time. And the Davidson case says that's no consideration. There is no valid promise. There is no contract.
How do you deal with Ms. Jordan's statement that it's not illusory because if the employee initiates the process, makes the claim, then the Halliburton is bound to go through arbitration? How does that make this illusory?
It is illusory at the time the contract supposedly is formed because, as written on page 5, an amendment can be made only when the employer has, and it's capitalized, actual notice. All of these rules, and these are the rules of the game, written by Brown & Root. Single space, small type, very legal ease. Now, is an employee able to read this? I suggest that some attorneys have trouble reading this, but is an employee able to discern that he must file an arbitration demand and prove that he has actual notice before there can be an amendment? I would say that's a very onerous, almost impossible burden for a worker with 30 years of welding to understand. I would say that at the time that this was negotiated and this was supposedly come into a binding situation, it was never a contract. So even that actual notice, Your Honor, that rule on page 5, it can be amended.
And it seems to me your argument could apply to the civil justice system.
Not exactly.
Our civil justice system violates constitutional rights because plaintiffs wouldn't ordinarily know that they have to file a lawsuit and get a citation issued and have it served within an answer within the 20 days or Monday next after 20 days. It seems to me you're not arguing about notice and voluntary waiver. You're talking about the process is just so complicated it's somehow unconstitutional.
I can see your point on the civil justice system, and yes, it's fairly complex. The difference here is this material is drafted, and it arrives in the mail. And by the employer getting up and going to work the next morning, like he's done for 30 years, it becomes binding. The civil justice system is not anything approaching that. This is not fair. And in the Hathaway case, talking about the notice, Hathaway set up, I think, a two-pronged test for notice.
Well, going back to Justice O'Neill's question, what would be the difference if he came to Brown looking for a job and they handed him this plan and said, we'll hire you if you agree to abide by this plan?
That could be different. And the difference there would be similar to, I'll think of the case in a moment, but, HEB, In Re HEB. The employee comes to the workplace and applies for a job, and the employer then has this program, and they explain to the...
They just hand the plan. They say, here's the plan. This is part of our terms and conditions of employment, either accept it or not. He accepts it. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is if the employee asks, what is this? What does that mean to me?
So if he doesn't ask and there's no oral discourse, it's void, but if he does ask, then it's valid.
No, I think in that instance, it arguably could be valid because it is the beginning of the arbitration plan. It is the plan itself. In our instance, the brochure was mailed with a rules booklet. And it just arrived in the mail, that's all.
But it arrived four times, and there were transmittal letters, and they said, this is a legal document, you need to read this, this is important, it applies to you. Isn't there any responsibility incumbent upon the employee to ask a question?
Yes, that is a responsibility, and employees get materials like that all the time. It's just more company paper sometimes in the practical application, but yes, they have a responsibility to read it.
What about our credit card agreements, our banking agreements that we get in the mail and the fine print, frequently changing the terms and conditions? Courts have routinely upheld those as binding on consumers. What's the difference?
The difference is that is not based on exclusively common law, contract law. We're in Texas. We're looking to the Hathaway case. We're looking to Texas common law principles of contract.
Well, isn't that a contract between the bank and the and myself in that instance as to how my checking account's going to be run?
Right. And the difference there is you and I have a lot more education than J.D. Myers did. I think it's on a case-by-case basis.
So J.D.'s can sue his bank and they change the interest they're charging?
Not necessarily. But the situation, I think each one has to be looked at individually. In Hathaway, there must be notice. Notice of what? So in Hathaway, it was notice of loss of income. In our case, it's notice of loss of constitutional rights. And so the amount, the detail, what is being explained to this person must be greater than would be explained to an attorney.
So
I think it matters.
This is a subjective test in terms of deciding whether or not the employee has sufficient notice. We're going to look at subjectively what the employee says. I understood, I didn't understand, as opposed to any kind of an objective test.
Your Honor, that would be a question of fact, and that, too, is answered in Hathaway.
Well, I understand, but what is the test, objective or subjective?
It is both. I think in a contract, if there's a contract form, there must be objective consideration where there any reasonable person.
No, I'm talking about his knowledge, the knowledge and understanding component.
I'm talking about that.
Is that an objective test or is it a subjective test?
For the person, for Mr. Myers, it's subjective. For the contract to be formed, just in like in a restated contract, it would have to be both. There would have to be an objective finding that there was consideration, and there would have to be a subjective counter on his part to say I did or didn't understand.
Let me ask, what is your view of the legal definition of unequal bargaining power? What does that mean?
My view of that, and that is discussed, I believe, in the Light case.
Is it just in your assessment that one party is more educated and has more control over the form than the other, or is it that one party has no option whatsoever? In other words, in this case, Mr. Myers could have remained with the company or could have decided I'm not going to continue my employment under these terms and found other employment. Is that enough just because that option was given to him, take it or leave it, does that mean it's unequal bargaining power? Or what does it mean legally?
No, Your Honor, that factor by itself does not mean unconscionability. That's a contract of adhesion, and that's been held by itself only is not unconscionable. But the fact where you have an employer with in-house counsel, they have written these rules, they can change these rules, and then they have an employee here that's been working here 30 years and welding every day. That is a different situation. You have education, you have resources, you have the wherewithal, you have the management.
So is it that arbitration agreements that that are in the terms of this agreement simply don't apply depending upon the education level of the employee? If they haven't, for example, haven't received a high school diploma, then you can't have arbitration?
Your Honor, I think it would have to be taken on a case-by-case basis because it's a question of fact.
And if it's taken on a case-by-case basis, then all of these arbitration agreements, especially for the major employers, are going to go away, aren't they?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they'll go away. I think it will be in each instance whether or not it will fit for that person. Did he understand it? And if he files suit in state court or federal court, the question will be, hey, was there binding promise to arbitrate?
And how does the employer decide whether or not the employee understands plain language? I mean, lay people don't even know what arbitration means.
Sure.
How is an employer supposed to assess whether or not the employee understands that.
That's true. That's a very good point. I think personally that in the front of these books, the first thing that should come in is all caps. You cannot sue your employer ever for any reason, for a bad reason, no matter how bad it gets. You cannot sue your employer if you accept this plan. And number two, if this comes in the mail and you get up and go to work, you're bound. They need to know that. That's not, this is explained here on the last page in smaller print, and then in the rules booklet in the middle on page 8, same lines, same small space. But for these people that are going to look at this, and they do look at these, but for this to be understandable so they can make a decision that's knowing, intelligent.
May I ask you a question? There was a period of, what, seven years before the situation arose where your client sued. From the June 93 to then, did he ever communicate to anybody at Brown and Root that even though he was aware of these mailings, he had no understanding and didn't know what it meant?
No, Your Honor. Factually, he did not. However, back to the reasoning here, the 1993 is the point when the contract is made or not made. It was not made. In fact, there's never been any actual notice from Brown and Root that they would like to arbitrate until they promise, they perform their promise, there's no contract. They promise to arbitrate. They have never sent an arbitration demand. In footnote 5 of the...
Have you demanded and they declined? Why would you institute a lawsuit or an arbitration proceeding against yourself and then come upon you to demand arbitration?
That's a good point, and they won't. That's the whole point of this.
Why would they? You're the one that wants... You have a claim against them, and it's incumbent on you to make the claim. I've got a claim. Let's arbitrate.
I was attempting to answer the particular question, but you led into, I think, a little bit of a different question. The way notice is given is unmistakable. It's clear, and that wasn't done here. So the fact that
Didn't he sue first?
Yes, he sued first.
And then they said, but there's an arbitration clause that we want to enforce.
Yeah, and he said, no, there's not.
I see.
There's
but at least they made a demand under what they thought was a valid dispute resolution program in the context of the lawsuit.
They would have to be the one to perform the promise. Promise to arbitrate. That's illusory. He is not bound until there is some contract. That's illusory.
Well, I understand your legal theory, but I thought you were answering Justice Holman and said, they never asked to arbitrate. And my question was, your client sued first, and then they said, but we have arbitration, and we asked for it. Your answer is, we don't think there's a contract, so you don't get it.
That's right. Brown Root is saying, you're bound, but I'm not.
Well, your client initially was saying he didn't understand. Now, in light of this legal proceeding, I'm sure your client understands what arbitration means. He continues to work at Brown and Root. Is the recourse here for him to terminate, not agree to this plan, and then seek constructive discharge?
No, Your Honor. His position, and I believe since I represent him, is that he should not be forced to arbitrate. He didn't promise anything. He never promised. There was never any agreement to arbitrate. And in arbitration, contract law decides. It is completely decided on contract law.
Well, that's different than your other argument. There are cases, and I think you referred to them, that the way these are set up, if the employee makes no response and continues working, then the law says he's acquiesced in that program. Do you agree with those cases?
The Alamo case, the Burlington case, no, I do not. I think they are incorrect. In fact, the Burlington case did not give the full burden of proof for the employer. They just said had to prove the modification. Hathaway says the employer has to prove knowledge, and they have to prove that this employee understood with the nature of the changes, and also the certainty of the imposition. The employer didn't do that. The employer has never done that because here, the nature of the changes, remember I said early on, is the constitutional right that's being lost. That's never explained. Second, the certainty of the imposition, it's everything but certain. They can amend. They can take this away. It is not certain. So I believe under the Hathaway case, the burden is to do much more. Burlington says only is asked to prove the modification. It would be easy to send this in the mail and say, here it is, but that's not their burden of proof. Also in Alamo, I disagree with that case because it stated just perfunctorily that mutual promises form consideration. Not when the mutual promise, the promise to arbitrate, is illusory. That case did not address that with the bilateral contract. Then the Alamo case went on to take full and straight on disagreement with Tenet Healthcare versus Cooper. Tenet Healthcare, 1995 case out of the Houston 14th Court of Appeals, said that it is illusory. It followed the Light versus Sintel reasoning that the promise, the illusory promise, is not consideration. And choosing between Alamo and Tenet Healthcare, I choose Tenet Healthcare.
Well, in Tenet Healthcare, the handbook said this is not binding. Here, clearly said, this is binding. So, I mean, those are very difficult cases to analogize.
The analogy is that the 14th Court said, we're not deciding that on the statement. We're deciding it on contract law. They said the controlling issue is whether a contract is formal.
But again, the handbook said over and over, this is not a contract. It's a different scenario entirely.
I think it would be depending on where the notice is. If it's in the middle on page 8 in single-spaced language, no. If it's on the very front that says you cannot sue your employer if you take this plan, yes. So it depends on where it is. And the wording in the Tenet Healthcare case was some different than ours, so that's some distinction. But I think for all cases, the standard to apply is whether an employee can make a decision knowingly, intelligently, knowing the full consequences, the legal consequences.
And you would have a jury trial on that issue before you ever reach the arbitration question.
That could be decided by the court in a hearing. I believe this whole matter of deciding whether or not a contract to arbitrate exists is the preliminary fact-finding.
Well, if it's a fact-finding, though, you'd be entitled to a jury trial in every single instance before you got to the arbitration.
As I understand arbitration law, and the United States Supreme Court has explained that the trial judge has the authority to have a hearing. And if either side requests a hearing on a motion to compel arbitration, the trial judge then hears evidence and he or she decides if there's a contract. If there's a contract to arbitrate, then everybody go ye and arbitrate. But that is early in the case, and that is the trial judge, not the jury.
And you think that's in the FAA? That would trump our state right to jury trial on the formation of a contract.
The FAA does not trump this court's authority. I think this court, of course, attempt to follow the FAA in arbitration settings because the Federal Arbitration Act applies in state court just as the Texas Arbitration Act does. So they're both applied in state courts. So I believe it would be incumbent on this court to follow those precepts under the FAA. But the case law has said if one person files a motion to compel arbitration, the first order of the day is for the trial judge to determine if there's a contract. And I believe the United States Court first options. It's a fairly recent thing.
If that's true, then there's no right to jury trial in the initial threshold question of whether there's a contract based on the authorities you're just relying on. It's a question of law.
Your Honor, my reading of the cases is that's a procedural matter. There has to be a hearing in arbitration setting. That's different from maybe negotiating real estate.
Well, under what you just said, what would be tried to a jury that you said your client's waived?
Once it's determined that there is no contract to arbitrate, then we go into the merits of the case. What is tried to the jury in this case would be whether or not Mr. Myers was demoted because he's over 50 and because...
Oh, I see what you're doing.
The merits of the actual discrimination case.
But on the other hand, assume then that the trial court performs that preliminary function and says, well, I believe that that's a valid contract to arbitrate.
At that point, either both parties have the opportunity and the right to appeal, because let's say that...
Yes, but what you can't do if you're the aggrieved party is say, this is wrong because it made me waive my right to a jury trial, because you've already conceded it's a legal issue that the court decides.
Let me go back through the steps. Maybe I wasn't clear.
Well, no, you were very clear that it's a preliminary decision made by the trial court without the intervention of a jury on whether it's a contract or not.
Yes, sir.
If you lose that issue, how can you argue that there's a constitutional deprivation of a jury trial on a legal question?
I think the question of unconscionability is always a fact question, depending on many circumstances. That can be tried before the jury.
Well, but isn't the question, is this contract unconscionable under our law? Not is there a fact question on unconscionability?
I must say, and I hold to the same answer, and I beg your patience, that the initial question before anything else is there a valid contract?
Yes.
And then the
but
question
the,
of arbitrability.
My point is the question of whether there's a valid contract, in your view, is here would encompass the issue of unconscionability. The next step is if it's a preliminary legal situation where the trial judge decides that issue, is there a contract, a valid contract? No jury intervention. So how can you claim deprivation of a constitutional right under your own theory of the case?
Almost. If I may go back, mm-hmm. Let's determine that the judge determined there was a contract to arbitrate. Then the next step was that contract that was formed unconscionable? Those are different questions. The very first question is there a contract to arbitrate, yes or no? At that point, either party loses, either party can appeal it, because that is a timing mechanism that must be done there. Let's say that there is no appeal, and they go on into the case. Then a fact issue will be unconscionability. And that
so we're going to have two trials on one contract?
No, sir, not two trials. We'll have a hearing and a trial.
Okay.
The hearing before the trial judge is much like hearings, for example,
here would encompass the issue of unconscionability. The next step is if it's a preliminary legal situation where the trial judge decides that issue, is there a contract, a valid contract? No jury intervention. So how can you claim deprivation of a constitutional right under your own theory of the case?
Almost. If I may go back, mm-hmm. Let's determine that the judge determined there was a contract to arbitrate. Then the next step was that contract that was formed unconscionable? Those are different questions. The very first question is there a contract to arbitrate, yes or no? At that point, either party loses, either party can appeal it, because that is a timing mechanism that must be done there. Let's say that there is no appeal, and they go on into the case. Then a fact issue will be unconscionability. And that
so we're going to have two trials on one contract?
No, sir, not two trials. We'll have a hearing and a trial.
Okay.
The hearing before the trial judge is much like hearings, for example, that we see when we're sitting in the courtroom waiting, and there's a hearing on whether or not this ad litem attorney has explained to these children what their rights are. But there will be an evidentiary hearing, and the answer is yes or no. Is there a contract to arbitrate? At that point, either one can appeal. If they don't, then they go on into the case, and one of the issues can be unconscionability. And that's how it's resolved.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We're obviously concerned about the parameters of unconscionability here and what an employer could unilaterally impose upon or take away from an employee. And that's a tricky issue as to how we go about doing that. But let me ask you this. What if Halliburton or Brown & Root were to amend the program unilaterally to say that any personal injury claims would be covered by this arbitration agreement, what would your position on unconscionability be in that instance?
Justice O'Neill, assuming that was subject to the Federal Arbitration Act, I think there could be no unconscionability issue there. Those kinds of programs have, in fact, been enforced in the courts.
Regarding personal injury?
Yes, ma'am. I believe so. I think one of the HEB cases that's reported and cited in one or both of our briefs actually involved personal injury claims. The unconscionability issue, it seems to me, goes in the at-will context, has little to do with procedural unfairness, everything to do with substantive unfairness. In this instance, for example, this program provides a right to the claimant, to a lawyer, to an independent hearing before, on the merits, before a neutral arbitrator, to discovery under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And on in terms of reserving the same rights that an employee would have in a court. The program guarantees to the employee every substantive right under law, including all remedies that are available in a court on his or her claim. And in my mind,
except
that
12 people instead of one.
Big pardon?
Except 12 people instead of one. Right to a jury trial.
Yes, Justice Becker, that's exactly right. And the United States Supreme Court recently in Circuit City addressing that same issue rejected out of hand the argument from the employee's side that arbitration proceedings inherently favor the employer in some way. And it said that the benefits of arbitration proceedings are inure equally to employees in employment discrimination cases, and that they are perhaps uniquely suitable to employment discrimination cases because so often these cases involve lesser sums of money and it is more difficult to prosecute them through the expensive litigation process. On the issue of the heightened standard and whether that's been applied anywhere outside the Ninth Circuit, I believe the answer to that is no. There's a case cited in our supplemental letter of authorities. It is the Haskins v. Prudential Sixth Circuit case from last year, 2000, noting that the Ninth Circuit's heightened standard for enforceability of these agreements has been rejected by nearly every court to consider it. I would also submit to you that the Ninth Circuit's approach to this, which was recently, one aspect of their approach, of course, was overturned by Circuit City, but their approach generally to these arbitration agreements strikes me as being clearly inconsistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Gilmer and Circuit City about the benefits of these programs and the fact that they have to be judged based on the same principles of state contract law that all other private agreements are judged on.
Mr. Jordan, Mr. Myers didn't have the same bargaining power that Brown has. Is that correct?
That is correct, Justice Jefferson.
What does unequal bargaining power mean as a legal term?
I do not know the precise legal definition of that term. I think I can respond to your question by saying that in an at-will employment situation, well, first off, I think as a matter of general law of unconscionability, you have to have both procedural unfairness, if you will, or one-sidedness, if you will, and then substantively unfair terms. On the procedural one-sidedness, I think my colleague, Ms. Gardner, has conceded that the cases say that's not enough by itself. In addition to that, here we have an at-will employment situation. And as I think Justice O'Neill asked Ms. Gardner right off the bat, couldn't the company have terminated Mr. Myers and all the other employees and then rehired them subject to a new contract that contained the arbitration provision? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. Hathaway allows at-will employers to operate more efficiently than that. That's a good thing.
And could they, in fact, have sent a letter to Mr. Myers saying, sign this agreement or you will be fired?
They could have done that, but they decided that was not the preferable thing to do.
But under your construct, they could do that because an at-will employee, you can do that.
I believe they could, Justice O'Neill. What they did instead, and I do take issue with the other side's statement that this was not clear and unequivocal notice, they sent him a letter from the chief executive officer of the company that said, enclosed are the materials, it's a new program, it applies to you and will govern your employment. Read these materials. He says, well, please read these materials in capital letters.
Mr. Jordan, does the record reflect any additional knowledge that the employee may have had regarding the program? For example, watching the company videotape, knowing that ombudsmen were present in the company, anything of that nature?
The record does not reflect that, Justice Rodriguez.
Why?
I know more. It was there, but
if this was such dandy notice, how come in 1996 you decided to get some signatures and you apparently didn't get his?
Well, there's a dispute about that, and we've chosen not to rely on that, obviously, because, if I digress one second and ask another question that was asked, there is a provision in the FAA that says that if there is a bona fide factual dispute about whether the contract was formed under state law principles or whether it's enforceable under state law principles that are defenses of enforceability of contracts, then you do have a separate trial on that issue. But that trial is held independent of any proceeding on the merits. There's no dispute in this record. I can speculate, Chief Justice Phillips, about why they sought the signature in 1996, but it would be speculation. It's not in the record. We don't think the signature is necessary, as the record does reflect. This program was implemented for all the tens of thousands of employees that Brown Reed had in the various states in which it does business by clear and unequivocal announcement. And this record is replete. Some of it is summarized in our briefs, especially the reply brief, replete with plain and clearly stated representations of what this program was about, that it was a new dispute resolution procedure with the Ombuds Office and the people there to assist with employee disputes, that those disputes could not be resolved, however, that the ultimate means of resolution was final and binding arbitration. The materials tell the employees that if they file a lawsuit, the company's going to ask to have it dismissed. The materials tell the employees that they waive their right to a judicial forum. By the way, the U.S. Supreme Court has said in the Gilmer and Circuit City cases, in response to another point that the other side has made, that the right to a jury trial under a statute, including the employment discrimination statute, is not a substantive right, that these agreements merely shift the forum. That was discussed in a full paragraph in Gilmer. That most of that paragraph is quoted verbatim in the Circuit City. Universal Maritime was cited by Ms. Gardner properly for the proposition that if a union, a representative rather than the individual himself, is waiving the statutory right to jury trial, then if that can be done at all, it must be done in a clear and unmistakable way. The court in Universal Maritime, the U.S. Supreme Court, also said, however, that Gilmer involved an individual's waiver of his own rights rather than the union's waiver of the rights of its members. And hence, and I'm quoting, and hence, the clear and unmistakable standard was not applicable to the individual waiver from Gilmer. The argument that this is small type and legalese, the formal plan statement and the rules, a copy of which are in the record, is a document that, as we point out in our reply brief, very similar to the rules of procedure that govern litigation. That is not the document that the company really intended to lay people to become available with. This is the resolution booklet, a copy of which is in the record. But it wasn't sent out in Xerox copy form. It was sent out in this nice brochure to all of these employees. And it is written by Mr. Meyer's own admission in his brief in language that can be understood by a layperson. Mr. Meyer, by the way, has a high school education and had advanced to a management level within the company.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.